It's time now for Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler. On Nonviolence Radio, we explore the active power of nonviolence. Nonviolence isn't passivity or inaction. It's actually what our friend Rivera Sun calls the third way, or a way between these two poles of action. And when you get inside of nonviolence, we find that it's a whole culture with a history all its own and a science all its own. And yet there's something that isn't just its own. It's something that's very human. It's what Mahatma Gandhi called the law of the humans. And so we're going to explore a little bit of this very intriguing law of the humans and from the scientific perspective on our show today, because we recently had in this country a march for science, a march for the truth that science stands for the objectivity and the way that the laws of the universe interact, and that they're objective, and that we can understand the problems of our world from a scientific perspective. Now, millions of people came out to march all over the world for this, and in fact, we thought that we would be remiss on Nonviolence Radio to not bring in the science of nonviolence into this conversation, because Gandhi is said to have listed something like 7, quote, social sins. And we don't like this word sin in general, because this is a word fraught with all sorts of connotations. But one of them was science without humanity. So as we're discussing the science of nonviolence, we do want to point out that not everything in science is necessarily helpful or useful, and not all scientists are necessarily going in the right direction. For example, the scientists working at weapons labs aren't necessarily, I would not go out and march for science for the work that they are doing, because this is work that destroys human life. You know, this is work that destroys our planet. And it's all work that's based on, we have to get deeper. And what's the foundation, what's the foundational principles beneath the discoveries and the research that's happening in science? So, for example, on Nonviolence Radio in the past, we've had animal behaviorist Franz de Waal join us. And he talked about the way that nobody before him had actually been doing research into cooperative behavior among primate species. Everything had been about, well, look at how warlike, look at how violent they are. And when he went to look for the literature that suggested another view to help understand how humans are cooperative and helpful and peacemaking, he couldn't find it. So he had a great opportunity to explore that himself. And on today's show, we're really blessed and lucky to have Elizabeth Sartoris, Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris, who's an evolution biologist, futurist. She's also a sustainability consultant to businesses, government agencies, and other organizations. She's appeared in such films as I Am and Occupy Love, and another film called Femme, and she's going to be in another film, and she can tell us more about that soon. And she's written several books, the most recent being Gaia's Dance, The Story of Earth and Us, which you can actually get for free on Kindle Unlimited or in the ebook form. You can also find that. So we want to welcome with much graciousness Elizabeth Sartoris to Nonviolence Radio. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth, you are a futurist, evolution biologist, sustainability consultant, author. What drives you to do this work in science in our world today?
Well, the reason I became an evolution biologist, which is a deep study of the past, so really a pastist, was to be a good futurist. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't know where you've come from, it's hard to tell where it's possible to go next. And then in the course of being an evolution biologist, I found that what I was taught in universities was very inadequate. There was something about the way Darwinism had come to run our economics that didn't seem right. It was all about competition, and where was the cooperation, as you just mentioned, Francois talking about, that science had not looked at the cooperative aspects of nature, which turn out to be far more important than the competitive ones. Mm. And yes, we are evolving, and the main aspect of evolution for humans has been how to live together as social creatures. So in some ways, we're more like the ants and the bees because we're so highly social. And in some ways, we're more like the ancient bacteria who had to learn how to get over their hostilities and into cooperation, because that maturation process in evolution is what we're caught in right now, where we're trying to figure out how to cooperate as a globalized species.
That's such an intriguing picture that you paint for us in terms of looking to our past and that in order to better understand who we are today and where we're going in the future. And you're coming at it from this perspective of an evolution biologist. So tell us more about this passing from stages of competition to greater and greater cooperation. How does the human being fit into this picture, really?
Well, what I discovered by going way back to the ancient bacteria that had the Earth to themselves for half of evolution and seeing the process in which they moved from kind of individual competition to cooperation in large cooperatives, to them very large, which actually turned into the nucleated cells that we humans are made of. And so that was the first huge leap in evolution, and it's ever more widely now accepted that this kind of leap is the really important thing to know about evolution. Now, whenever such a cooperative develops, it's new on the planet and has to go through its own youth. So youth is the expansive mode. It's like what we did up through teenage, where our cells kept dividing and making us bigger and taller, right? And then we had to move into leveling off for the rest of our lives. Well, those ancient cells that we're made of, when they were new, it took them a billion years to get through their youthful phase into forming multi-celled creatures, which was the second great leap in evolution. And now we're up to ourselves, because we are multi-celled creatures, and we know about the evolution of things starting in the sea and coming onto land and the flowers and the dinosaurs and all that, because that's the part we learned in school. So when we look at human evolution, we see that we got together in ever larger groups, starting with families and kinship groups and so forth. And as we became larger social groups, we had to work harder to make sure that cooperation was maintained in them. So the first cities were actually devised, they grew from little villages and towns where trade routes crossed, and then grew into big cities. Cities are very natural entities when they have grown from little towns, expanded into their large size, and then grown stable. So unless they were built overnight by, you know, in China nowadays or in the Middle East, they are living entities. If you look at a city from an airplane, you see that it looks like a cell on a substrate, on a slide or something, or like an amoeba where you see the central hub, the nucleus, and then all the transportation systems going out toward the countryside and the supply lines moving around. So I got fascinated by that, and my city of Honolulu has now been chosen by Rockefeller Foundation as one of the 100 cities around the world that they are studying and linking in terms of problem solving. So in order to run something the size of a city, much less a nation or a world, you have to have a lot of peacekeeping going on and a lot of rituals and bonding. And this is the essence of humanity, is how do we get along well with each other without, as we call it, disturbing the peace, right? But because of the youthful phase that always raises up again. Every time you have a new entity, such as cities becoming competing with each other to build empires. And so we mm-hmm. have the American Empire at present as kind of the last one in the world, since Russia and China are, China's a quieter empire because it's learned how to build an empire peacefully. Mm. The American Empire is still in the youthful aggressive phase. Mm-hmm. And now this new wave of being anti-science is an interesting topic in itself that I think Michael would like to talk about.
Michael.
Actually, thank you, Elizabeth Satouris. I'd like to get you to talk about it. But before we do, I had a question. I'm fascinated by one comment you made that all of these cooperative entities, tell me if I'm not paraphrasing you correctly, all these cooperative entities tended to be cooperative internally, but could still be competitive with other entities, either in the same species mm-hmm. or not. And then what we're looking at now, I believe, is the end of that process, because there is no other entity than the population of planet Earth, and we have to solve this thing once and for all. Do you feel that that's a reasonable overview?
Yes, absolutely. And that's the new wave in evolution. And David Sloan Wilson is one of the best proponents of that. And E.O. Wilson, of course, more classically from Harvard. And they both understand very well the difference between the individual selection in evolution and the group selection. You see, individuals gain advantage against each other through hostilities, but groups are selected for their internal peacefulness, for their internal cooperation. And as I said, the groups are getting larger and larger, and as you just pointed out, we now have to work within an entire planet. We've hit the limits. And this is a fascinating process, and we're caught in this adolescent crisis where it is still profitable for nations to compete with each other. Wars are only carried out now because they are financially profitable. It's not because people want these fights anymore. I think all of these fights could be resolved by things like conflict resolution. I've known so many conflict resolution teams. Whenever they're brought in, they succeed. People basically have this instinct for cooperation, but we're manipulated by those to whom it's still advantage. And I think the main thing that we really need to understand now, and this is not taught even to MBA students in business schools, is how the global financial system works. Because we were warned against it 2,000 years ago when Jesus threw the moneylenders out of the temple and the Jews forgave all debts every 7 years, and Islam said that interest was charging interest was a bad idea. So here we are with a money system preventing us from growing up cooperatively because it's still a system designed to funnel money to the top through competition. So until we get that and until we understand that democracy can only work when you see that nature is profoundly conservative with things that work and radically creative with things that don't work, and that should be a cooperative division of labor rather than letting the big powers in the world divide you and tell you this is antagonistic, and every 4 years you're supposed to, you know, you're real participants in the system, and you have to decide which one are you going to do. Are you going to be conservative, or are you going to be progressive radical? And we can't get democracy that way. And we now have not only the divide between the political parties, the conservative and radical, but it's become a divide educationally. And the reason why we're seeing this anti-science now is because education is teaching people things that are inconvenient truths to those who are still keeping the system running on an empire-building debt money system.
Elizabeth, that you have just given us so much. But
I get no.
That's what you are here for. But I got I picked up again on one particular thing that you said is funneling resources to the top through competition. And again, it seems to me that we've reached the absolute climax of that with the present administrative arrangements in the United States.
Exactly.
Well, so this is really like a kind of a cultural Armageddon that we're facing. And I think the anti-scientific thrust, which I believe is doomed because humanity cannot but seek truth, is a good example of the crisis that we're up against and what the advantages are that we would have to play it to a good result.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, science has basically been responsible for the knowledge evolution of humans, the knowledge explosion of humans. But remember that the way science became so powerful was that when Europe used to be run by a coalition between the church
the nobility.
The nobility, yes, of course. The church and nobility in alliance with each other ran the show. And then as the new young entrepreneurs came up through the Industrial Revolution, they found scientists very useful in building the Industrial Revolution. So they took over, that new alliance took over in the building of secular states, where science was elevated to the kind of priesthood position where they can tell you how things are in our universe. So science has been telling the creation story. And that's come to a head now with this education divide. We're back in the Scopes trial days, kind of, where science to the relatively uneducated part of the population has always been a kind of anathema because it's godless. That's how it's prevented. Well, science itself underwent a very important split 100 years ago or so when the quantum science came into play. And the quantum physicists found that the worldview that they had been taught, that science is that the universe is a material energetic entity that has no meaning, no purpose, no intrinsic intelligence. This didn't work for the quantum scientists, and they had to look to the East, to the Vedic science of consciousness as primary, to understand their own results as they went through the world of matter, down through the atom, down through the particles, and hit a field of consciousness, basically. So while science had taught that consciousness is a late emergent product of material evolution, they suddenly saw that consciousness was the source of all material evolution, that every particle was coming out of a field of consciousness, that we are recreated in every moment. And that kind of worldview just pops open the divide between religion and science. But it hasn't caught on in the popular mind because science itself is still operating, for the most part, in this Newtonian universe and doesn't know how to admit that its quantum theory is respected for its mathematics, for its predictability, but physics students are kind of told to suck it up as far as the philosophy goes because it doesn't fit the rest of science. So I think we need to heal that split within science and to look at our basic models of the universe and see if we can make peace within them. It's exemplified by the search for a unified theory in science, which still hasn't come up because this unacknowledged conflict is going on within the field. But in the culture at large, you know, this is when science becomes inconvenient to them as has the gold makes the rules kind of society, then it can be put down, you know, and that's what we're getting. And it's really a war against all of education More than just the war against science. Right? Science is being picked on right now because climate change is inconvenient to the fossil fuel industry.
That is just so intuitively and rationally and intellectually rings so true and so thorough. I really like your suggestion that it's hard for science to admit certain things. I see this kind of problem also in the field of nonviolence, which overlaps with the field of science. I don't know if you were a friend with Kenneth Boulding. He's one of the fathers of peace research and also a scientist. And he said that nonviolence and science have something in common, that when they discover truth, they hold on to it. And when they discover falsehood, they reject it. And of course, for Gandhi, nonviolence simply was a part of science. And so in both fields now, what I think we're seeing is we're trying to solve problems through rational argument, which are much deeper than that. And I've been thinking of this wonderful quote from Jonathan Swift, where he said, "There's no use trying to argue a man out of a position which he never was argued into in the first place."
Yes.
So how do we approach that?
Well, that is the big question now, because one of the things that science is showing so clearly now is that humans don't operate on rational decision-making, and that includes the most highly educated, sophisticated people on the planet. We are all still driven by our guts and our hearts more than our brains. And we tend to hang out with like-minded people. One of the things I loved about living so many years in Greece was that when you went to a party, it tended to have people of all political persuasions at it. People they weren't hostile to each other socially on political lines, but we are in this country. And I think that our most highly educated people, on the whole, are terribly ignorant about how they themselves work and how the rest of the world works. They think it's only, those Trump voters or something like that, you know, that don't act rationally. But few of us act rationally. We are far more complex creatures. Our emotional intelligence is very important. And we need to face our own shadows, all of us. And heal all of these divides, and we can do it. Humans have shown it over and over and over again, that they can become cooperative within groups. We just have never faced a global group before.
Do you perhaps not think, Elizabeth, that we also need to see the great light that's within us, and that it may be even more critical now than facing the shadow side? I hope that isn't a leading question.
No, that's very good of you to bring up, Michael, because of course that's true, that you don't see shadows without light to start with. We do need to understand that when we go within, as the quantum physicists basically, they went within. In order to explain what they were finding in the lab, they had to go inward in the sense of the Vedic system, which has taught us meditation and yoga and all of those things, to recognize that there are no lines, there are no divisions in the source of creation, which is everything. Once you see that matter has formed within consciousness and that it is another version of consciousness playing out these wonderful movies, then you know that there are no real divisions and that we all reflect each other's essences and realities, and that we're already in this soup together without boundaries. And another thing that science has finally discovered is microbes, the microbial world, that we're made of far more microbes than these nucleated cooperative cells, and that those microbes are working almost slavishly for us to keep us healthy, but our minds can interfere with our own health. And so we are constantly trading microbes with everything in the world. And it's like a symbol on a physical level of our incredible oneness and the futility of maintaining hostilities. It doesn't mean we can't compete. Friendly competition is great. That's why the Greeks thought up the Olympics, and competition can be used to drive excellence. And one of my favorite things I'd love to see schools do is just before one of the ball games, have somebody come out and tell the audience that tonight they're going to cheer for excellence by cheering for the points on both sides. And the kids won't be aware of it, the coach won't be aware of it, but at the end they will then announce that the team that made the most points is going to have a party for the other team because it drove them to a little greater excellence. You know, just reframing the context in which we see things can bring us to a vibrant, creative world of peace.
Elizabeth Satouris, evolution biologist, futurist and author of the latest Gaia's Dance, The Story of Earth and Us. We've loved having you on the show, and we're just applauding here in the background because it's so exciting to hear what you're saying. And yet there's a question that remains in me, which is, as we've evolved from these small cells into larger complex systems, and we're talking about the human context now and the way that we work with conflict and competition and cooperation, how have you thought about the evolution of us in terms of what is the driving force underneath all of this? And we're becoming conscious of consciousness, but at what point did that begin, and where are we going, do you think? And I guess this is a bit of a futurist question for you.
Well, once you see the universe as being primarily cosmic consciousness is just inherently creative all the time. It's what the universe does. And I've always wondered, you know, what is sustainability about in this massive, you know, creative venture? And I think sustainability is about building harmony with whatever is around you, whatever you is, whether it's a city, whether it's an individual, whether it's an action. If everything in that surrounds that in this wildly creative universe is in harmony with it, so that it feeds it and it allows it to put out whatever it can't use anymore, then those things will survive in this creative universe. So if we start to treat each other the way we want people to treat each other in the future, and eat the foods we think would be good, and build the kind of buildings we think would be good, and then we start to live the future now because we are co-creators of it. It's not something that's going to happen on its own. It happens because of how we behave within it. So the more we become internally peaceful and creative, and then, you know, send that love out to everything around you, it starts to respond with love, too, when we grow it.
Elizabeth, I almost feel, listening to you, that the word sustainability isn't good enough. It's like...
No, it's a poor word.
Yeah, it's like the word survival that we had in the nuclear
survival
age.
Survival is the best word I know, but I give that away to the Thrive movement.
Thrive, or expand, or find our purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the way, the title of the manuscript of a book that I've written, which with great trepidation I'm going to show you at some point, is called The Third Harmony.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, good. I'm so glad to hear you say that.
Yes, Toffler's Third Wave and your Third Harmony.
That's right. That's right.
They I love it. That well makes together. A full chord.
I love the musical imagery. Well, Elizabeth, this has been so wonderful speaking with you. You've really given us and our listeners so much that's insightful for us to help us understand the situation that we're in and how to approach it. And I hope we can have you back on our program at some point.
Good, Michael. And I know we're all looking forward to your film. Does it have a title?
Yes, actually, you'll like it, I hope. So, Elizabeth, it's called The Journey Home.
Oh, lovely. Perfect.
Good. Thank you very much for that plug, and thank you for everything. As I say, I hope we can have you back on before too long.
Great. Lots of love to you all, Stephanie and you and everybody out there in Radioland.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Efrat Stumer.
You're at Nonviolence Radio, and we just had a conversation with futurist and evolution biologist and author Dr. Elizabeth Satouris, which is a wonderful guest to have on our show this week, especially with the March for Science just having completed last Saturday. And what we wanted to emphasize with our interview with Dr. Satouris is that there is a science behind what nonviolence is and how it works, and that science is also evolving to include nonviolence, which we certainly got out of that interview with her. Now, Michael, you were raised in the family with a scientist, and so science has been very important to you in your search for nonviolence in our world today. Did you have any concluding comments about our interview with Dr. Satouris?
You know, Stephanie, I actually have quite a few, and let me pick one or start with this one. And Gandhi had talked about that seventh social sin, or it was one of his list anyway. It was science without humanity. And I think I'd like to say that nonviolence is science with humanity. It's where humanity comes first, and science is a function of humanity and not the other way around. Because what we're having today is, in this world, I think we have science and science, if I can put it that way. We have science, which is a disinterested search for truth, which should never, never be impeded. And we have science, which is put to the service of some less than healthy impulses. And I remember that Robert Oppenheimer, who played such a critical role, in a way, he kind of represents this whole split in himself, because he was a gentle, loving person, had an instinct for justice, quoted the Bhagavad Gita, as we all remember, and come his time. And yet he participated in this horrendous weapon, the development of this weapon. And he once said that the purpose of science is to take the forces of nature and put them at the disposal of the human will. Well, which human will are we talking about? You know, if it's going to be put at the will of the people who have the most money to support the research and build the equipment, those people that towards whom all the resources are being funneled by competition, as Elizabeth Satouris just said, or is it going to be put at the will of people who are looking for the uplift of humanity and in our increased growth, are finding our way back, if you will, to the path of evolution, the path towards harmony. And so it's really extremely interesting that science has come under attack at this point. It's come under attack, I think, as a general part of the more general attack on truth, the manipulation of truth, which was made explicit under the administration of George W. Bush, where people actually, one of his staff people in the White House said, "We make up our own reality now." Oh, someday I'll read you that whole quote in the exact words that Ron Suskind was so horrified to hear there in the White House. And so that's a kind of arrogance which cannot capture the deepest aspirations of the human being, and which can only lead to disaster. And in a way, as in so many other ways, it's good that the struggle has come to this point, that it's come to this climax, where it's actually out in the open now, the explicit disavowal of truth and the mechanism by which human beings have discovered the truth of the outside world, including the truth that Elizabeth was just describing so brilliantly, that there is no outside world and that there is no material universe, as she put it. Matter is another version of consciousness, or as the Vedic sages sometimes put it, matter is an illusion created by the infinite capabilities, the infinite creativity of consciousness. So it's an extremely critical time. And as you were pointing out, Stephanie, this is kind of personal to me because my dad was a very passionate scientist. When asked what his religion was, I sometimes said he was an orthodox biologist. And so he bequeathed to me that search for truth, but somewhere along the way, probably my mother played a big role in this, I came to feel that love and cooperation and harmony have to be the guiding value of that search.
Right, because when I think about some of the images that I saw from the March for Science, I saw signs that were saying, I believe in science, and which is fine, but there are aspects of science which lead us down roads that we don't want to go down, including this divide between either you're with us or against us, which is mm-hmm. part of the problem that, science is true no matter what you say. Well, you know what? Not all science is actually truth. It's a series of hypotheses that are based to get certain outcomes for certain that are based on certain worldviews. So one thing that I found very interesting about what Dr. Satoris was pointing out is that as she's explaining a different vision from which her science is emerging, the new science of the human being, of consciousness, of the evolution of who we are, of creatures and so forth, is that she points out, oh, there's problems in the economic system. You know, it leads us to conclusions like that. Or the way that we do competition is hurting us. You know, so it's coming right up against some of the most entrenched money-making systems in our world today. So I think that there's really something there that if we begin to unpack science, it's not enough if we just say we stand for science. We actually have to go in, as you were saying, into that deeper worldview and say, well, what kind of worldview am I supporting and what kind of science is behind that and what outcomes does that express?
So one great thing that could come out of all of this, along with the revolution, would be the purification of science itself, maybe an introspection among scientists to see where they have failed to bring the public along with them. I don't know if I have a right to say this, not being a professional scientist myself, but I'm reminded of something that Swami Vivekananda said about education. He said, the trouble with you people here in the West is that you educate for the head only. You do not educate for the heart. That will only make you 10 times more greedy, and that will be the death of you. He was very strong about that, and I think that maybe is what we're seeing now. So science as a particular and very vigorous dimension of education has to start from an orientation of the heart, has to start from, if you will, the faith position, or at least the hypothesis, that truth cannot be harmful. And when we have turned the powers of nature, as Oppenheimer was saying, to horrendously harmful purposes, then we're not discovering truth in some kind of deep sense. You know, as Gandhi said, you must always tell the truth, but never an unkind one. Because for him, kindness, love, harmony was the highest truth. Mm-hmm. So if it's a truth short of that highest truth, then it's just a fact.
And I do want to go back to this idea of this divide between science and anti-science, because here we're talking, the March for Science is in particular about climate change and climate justice. However, besides that split between the Industrial Revolution and then, science replacing the priests in some way, as she was talking about, I read another piece, I think that was an analysis on Gandhi's views on technology, but because he believed that people really needed to be doing work. People needed to do work with their hands and to create crafts, and because their art, their artistry, their humanity expresses itself through the things that we're able to do and build, which is a bit of a Marxist view in a way. but that's another topic. And what happened in the Industrial Revolution is that jobs were taken away from people through science.
Or so, through technology.
Yeah. And so, well, the technology, the science of technology or technology of science. So that there is also this basic fundamental fear of regular blue-collar people who are losing their jobs to technology.
You know, since we just had a Greek-speaking visitor on, the ancient Greek word for a function, a purpose, was timē, which is the same word as your worth, your honor. Mm-hmm. So when we put people out of work, or when we make them do somebody else's work, actually, which is what a lot of industrial work is, we deprive them of their value, their own sense of worth, and we deprive them of the ability to realize themselves because they're doing somebody else's work and not their own. So those are two profoundly wrong things about our modern industrial system. And I hope that when the inevitable shakeups happen, that these things will be taken into account. Mm. Well, Stephanie, should I go on to take a look at the news for this week?
Oh, please, Michael.
Thank you. That was a leading question again. I'd like to follow our usual format for this week, but we are contemplating moving to a new format where we will look at news through the lens of the three concentric circles of our roadmap. You can look at our website and look at the roadmap tab to see what I'm talking about. But we feel that action will have to grow from personal empowerment to constructive action on to confrontational action. And so we're going to be looking at things in that lens as an experiment pretty soon. But for now, I'm going to just look at a couple of sample resources, a couple of sample news items, and a couple of sample events. So for resources, I want to mention a new book by Jeremy Brescher. And this Jeremy writes a lot of books, as a glance at his Amazon page will show you. But his new book is very timely. It's called Against Doom: A Climate Insurgency Manual. That's really critical now in the aftermath of the Science March and the upcoming Earth Day climate marches, which are actually going to happen tomorrow, so if you're listening to us live. So this book was released last month, and he calls it A Handbook for Halting Global Warming and Restoring Our Climate, A How-To for Climate Insurgents. Climate insurgents. I really like that. A different kind of resource is given by our friend Maria Stefan in an article that appeared yesterday in Waging Nonviolence. Waging Nonviolence, as you may have noticed, has the tendency now to list only two really good articles in each of their online editions. And I think it's a very good format. But Maria's article, which is an opinion held also by Stephen Zunas and myself and many who look at the Middle East through a nonviolence lens, is that the only way to solve the Syrian crisis without the destruction of the entire country is to reach in there and contact and support the nonviolence movements, which, as we've mentioned on this program, actually do exist. And as Maria points out, she has terrific expertise in the area, that these groups include the White Helmets, the Violations Documentation Center, Syria Deeply, Project Amal Usalam, which I believe means love or peace, the Center for Civil Society and Democracy in Syria, and so on and so on, Violet Organization. Now, the first one that she mentioned is one that we've also talked about on this program called the White Helmets. These are people who wear white helmets, as the name might imply, and they go out after a shelling or a bombing and tear through the rubble and try to rescue people. It's incredibly dangerous work. They feel very, very proud of what they are doing, and they, of course, have lost some of their own people doing it. But I wrote quickly to Maria because there is a rumor mill going on saying that the White Helmets are a front of some kind for the al-Nusra Front or some very unsavory groups. And I'm happy to quote for you what she just told me this morning, this just in. Quote, I haven't seen any evidence to justify the rumors. So it looks like those rumors were another example of the famous alternative facts, a.k.a. lies. Anyway, Maria points out that the nonviolence began in Syria with a few young people practically children, going out and putting anti-government posters on the wall, and they were brutally, brutally handled, and there was protest against that. And we've reported earlier on how there were nonviolent civil society groups that started up. But that started up in 1911, and they were basically crushed by the end. I'm sorry, 2011. And they were basically crushed by the end of 2012. So they had only 1 year to do their work. And she is the co-author, of course, with Erica Stefan, of Why Civil Resistance Works. And one of the remarkable findings in that book, a good example of a good use of science, by the way, one of the remarkable findings was that on the average, it takes a nonviolent insurrection about 3 years to run its course, which is interesting because it takes a violent one close to 10 years. So we're talking about being twice as effective in one-third the time. And I just want to mention here, there are other most amazing finding, which is very understandable if you know nonviolence theory, that when a nonviolent insurrection fails, quote-unquote, that is, it fails to dislodge the regime, it still is four times likelier to lead to greater democratic reforms than a violent insurrection, even if it, quote, succeeds, unquote. And we're used to that in the nonviolence world because we know that most, as Gandhi said, most of the action of nonviolence is under the surface. And most of it comes from the means that you employ. And it is not so much about the end, a process toward which you work. So this is something that should be taken seriously by the people today who have the slogan, by any means necessary. Because the means are the ends in the making. So to move on a little bit, there's also an excellent article that appeared in Common Dreams by a Chicago journalist whom we've been in touch with years back called Robert Kohler. He was responding on April 20th to the rocket attack on Syria that we launched. And I want to read you a rather lengthy quote from Kohler because I think it's right on. He writes, "The U.S. seems to have gotten several things fundamentally wrong in this attack, and dozens of civilians paid the price." And that, in turn, was a quote from Ole Solvang, who's a deputy emergency director of Human Rights Watch, who was quoted in the Associated Press. And Solvang goes on to say, "The U.S. authorities need to figure out what went wrong, start doing their homework before they launch attacks, and make sure it doesn't happen again." So here's Kohler's answer to what went wrong. What went wrong is that bombing runs accomplished pretty much nothing except to spew death, fear, and hatred. They don't work. War doesn't work. This is the most ignored truth of the 21st century. The second most ignored truth is that we can create peace nonviolently through hard work, patience, and courage. Indeed, humanity is already doing so, mostly, of course, beyond the awareness of the corporate media, parenthesis, but not beyond the awareness of nonviolence radio, close parenthesis, which does nothing so much as perpetuate what Walter Wink has called the myth of redemptive violence. At some point, I'd like to comment on that work and that concept by the recently deceased friend Walter Wink. But to move on to some of the news, starting in the U.S., our representative from this area, Jared Huffman, has co-sponsored with Representative Barbara Lee, based in Oakland, the U.S. Department of Peacebuilding Act, which is House Resolution 1111. Easy to remember that number. I want to comment that this hits close to home as the University of California has just significantly downgraded the Peace and Conflict Studies program that I founded there about 40 years ago, downgraded and all but eliminated it. So it looks like an area in which the famous, innovative, cutting-edge university has fallen behind. Okay, well, back off my grandstand now and back onto the news. Campaign Nonviolence, CNV, will be facilitating and coordinating, to the extent that they do coordinate, nationwide actions again this year, again in September, this time September 16 to 24. If you remember, tens of thousands of people participated last year. And I'd like just to add a reflection on that, which I have shared with my friends at CNV. Wouldn't it be wonderful, meaning wouldn't it lead to something much more effective, if these actions were organized into a coordinated strategy? I mean, I feel very strongly that the two things that we need very badly right now, we being the resistance movements, are on the one hand training and on the other hand strategy. Training is kind of getting there. There's trainings popping up all over the place. I've mentioned the Nonviolence Training Hub as a resource. But strategy is really in its infancy. And this doesn't mean that everyone would have to do the same thing. It just means that our actions would have to be coordinated in an overall plan. Watch for more news in June when the Meta Center puts on a strategy summit. Okay, I want to mention that the first semester is over, and that I'm talking, of course, about the Resistance School at Harvard University. Last night, they had DNC Vice Chair, the Democratic National Committee Vice Chair Michael Blake, reflecting on background, skills, and our service. And they comment, the Resistance School folks comment, as you turn the skills you've learned at Resistance School into service, we're here to help. So this is, again, an interesting educational experiment. It was started in the grassroots, not by the administration, not by the faculty. And it seems like some of the best things happen in the student population, like the Greensboro boycotts. And I would hope that they broaden their scope to include nonviolent theorists and activists in the next semester. And you can write to them, incidentally. I found them amazingly responsive, even though they're handling 50,000 people in their online course. Okay, well, you know that scientists marched on April 22nd to the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and all around the country. You saw teach-ins, lines of people in lab coats and blackboards laden with equations. And it was possible to join them at a march wherever you live at marchforscience.com. I want to comment that there's a growing and I would say very welcome trend towards connecting the many issues that we are faced with. It's reminiscent of Campaign Nonviolence's triple focus, which is on a culture of peace and nonviolence free from war, poverty, and racism. And again, our roadmap that I mentioned aims at very much the same thing. Moving on to some news around the world, this is a bit of a departure, but I don't want to ignore the negative developments altogether. And one of them is that we have an international alliance, a worldwide alliance of right-wing parties. This was proclaimed earlier this year. And so it just, I think, by way of stimulating us to get into some kind of alliance also. The big events that are coming up, there is the Climate Day, the Earth Day March. There is a Global Youth and Peace Fest happening in India and a peace festival in Iran, toward which I will be contributing a webinar on May 7th.
Thank you so much, Michael Negler. And for more nonviolence in the news, you can visit our website, www.metacenter.org. That's Meta with two T's. We want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us for another episode of Nonviolence Radio. We definitely want to thank our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Satouras, who joined us all the way from Hawaii to talk science with us a little bit. To our mother station, KWMR, to all of the volunteers and staff and friends of the Meta Center for Nonviolence and everybody else. Till the next time, take care of one another and we hope to see you soon.